Tens of millions pledged to help victims of a monster storm. Today, Monday, November 11th, this is The World. I'm Aaron Schachter. A huge international effort is underway to help storm survivors in the Philippines. But the devastation on the ground is keeping a lot of that aid from reaching those most in need. Some Filipinos worry that the urgency will fade.
Open your hearts and help the Philippines. Please, do not abandon us. Please, continue to help us.
We'll hear from witnesses, survivors, and journalists in the Philippines, plus a climate scientist who studies storms.
There is a reason that we give these storms names. They all have their individual characteristics, like snowflakes.
And a new Marvel comic superhero. She's a Pakistani-American teen from New Jersey.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, supporting the American Diabetes Association in their effort to prevent and cure diabetes and to improve the lives of all people affected by diabetes. You can test your risk for diabetes at StopDiabetesNow.com.
I'm Aaron Schachter in for Marco Werman, and this is The World. The scale of the devastation in the Philippines is almost beyond comprehension. 10,000 feared dead after their cities and towns were destroyed by one of the most powerful storms ever recorded. Yet the focus now is on helping survivors of Typhoon Haiyan. Hundreds of thousands are displaced and in need of basics like food, water, and shelter. A huge international relief effort is underway, but some local residents are trying to do their share as well. Kevin Vaca is a former U.S. Marine who's been a missionary in the Philippines for the past 14 years. He and his wife live on Cebu Island. He says they were among the first to arrive to the devastated northern tip of Cebu after the storm.
Some areas, there's no house standing. The only thing you see is mattresses hanging in trees, couches out in the field where houses used to be. Thousands of clothes just hanging on broken branches of trees. People had lost everything.
Vaca helped clear the road so relief supplies could get in, including about 500 pounds of rice that he was carrying. The real problem, he says, is the lack of clean water.
Most of these small towns have these little bottled water filtration family businesses. Those that have a generator are making water for people to drink, but there's no water for toilets, there's no water for hygiene, it's only water to drink, but we're thankful for that.
Vaca estimates that some 75,000 people are homeless today in northern Cebu. Cirilo Sena lives in Lapu-Lapu, right next to Cebu City. He and his wife and son are safe, but he still hasn't been able to contact his sister. Sena works from home, providing technical assistance for a U.S.-based company. He answers email messages from American consumers. And today, he's counting his blessings.
I'm lucky. My house is made of concrete, but the roof is made of plastic. That part is destroyed. Those who lost houses here are those who can't afford concrete house. Just coastal area, just 5 minutes walk from where I am, there are people there who built their houses on the beach.
Mm-hmm.
These people don't have, they don't have properties. All their houses are gone. My parents' house, like half of the roof is gone. And my parents are safe. So that's a good thing still.
Well, we're happy to hear that.
But 2 hours from here, going north, the houses there were just wiped out. You know, like houses made of cards.
Do you know now that your sister is okay? Have you been able to contact her?
No, unfortunately, their phone still won't ring. Even my cousin's there. None of their phones ring.
You have a job working with an American company. And what do you do?
I just answer emails for the company. Technical support. For 2 days, I had no connection, no electricity. What I did was I went to the mall. That's how I coped, so I can still do my work. I was still able to make the required hours for the week. I'm lucky, but my other colleague, he lost 3 days. And my other colleague, 40 minutes from here, she lost 2 days also.
Are you the kind of service where people email and complain? My service isn't working, my product isn't working, that kind of thing?
Yeah, we still get those emails complaining.
Well, I wonder how it feels for you with all this devastation around you to have to answer emails from Americans concerned about a website.
Yeah, I can't blame them. So when I went back to work, and in the middle of my worrying about my sister, whom I still cannot contact, I went back to work, right, and answering complaints to those people, right? This is only email, though. Well, they don't know that we are in the Philippines. Only a few knows. On that day, I was really, like, floating, like, I can't really think straight, right? Because I just came from a super typhoon. I'm not even sure if my answers were right during that day. And yeah, you're right. I thought, like, wow, these people are so concerned about this, and they don't know that the person answering them just survived a major catastrophe, right? That's a funny part.
Why did you try working at all? Wouldn't it be perfectly reasonable to take a few days off at this time?
I have to, you know, do my best and secure my job. I mean, I have to answer these people's problems, though they're very small problems about the website, but yeah, I need to make sure that I still have a job, you know.
That was Cirilo Sena speaking to us earlier from Lapu-Lapu City in the part of the Philippines hit hard by Typhoon Haiyan. Jojo Malig is the deputy news editor at ABS-CBN News in the capital, Manila. He says despite the massive relief operation in the Philippines, some of those who need help the most have yet to receive it.
It's been terrible, quite terrible for the survivors this past few days. Many have not received aid. They're desperately looking for food, water. They're looting stuff from neighbors, from malls.
Do you get the impression, Jojo, that the looters are people desperate for food, or are they people, you know, trying to get what they can grab?
They're driven by desperation. They have lost everything. They've lost their houses, they've lost their belongings, and aid does not reach them. The roads are closed. The airport has just been reopened, and efforts are underway, but I hope it reaches them in time.
Jojo, the Philippines is said to be the most exposed to tropical storms in the world because of its location along the Ring of Fire or the typhoon belt. You've certainly gone through a lot of natural disasters in just the past 10 years. How are people in general dealing with all of this?
We've been dealing with it, I think, in a rather good way. We try to bounce back every time disaster hits. But many lessons have to be learned with regard to the recent typhoon. Efforts were made to bring people to safer ground, but some people died inside evacuation centers themselves, and perhaps the government should reassess emergency procedures.
Some of these storms, though, seem next to impossible to really fight.
Yep. There ought to be a more comprehensive program in regard to preparing and evacuating people out of harm's way.
Editor Jojo Malig with ABS-CBN News in Manila. Typhoons are tropical cyclones, just like hurricanes. They just happen to be in the Pacific rather than the Atlantic. But despite being similar in nature, the storms are studied in different ways. So says Carrie Emanuel, a professor of atmospheric science at MIT.
Part of the problem in the Western Pacific is we're not actually measuring typhoons very well. We did fly aircraft into them in the period up to 1987, and we make quite good measurements of their intensity in those days. But today, we rely on satellites, which are very good for detecting the presence of typhoons, but not all that great in measuring their strength.
How powerful was this one? Do we know?
Well, we don't know, and unfortunately, in all probability, we'll never know. I do know that some of the analysts who are used to working with Pacific typhoons, when they looked at the images of this latest one, have said that it had the most violent satellite presentation they recall seeing.
What made this particular storm so deadly?
Most of it is because the storm happened to reach peak intensity just about the time it made landfall. You know, storms have life cycles, and it's really a coincidence if they happen to reach their peak right when they strike a populated area. Most storms, there are a lot of Cat 5s out in the Western Pacific, and some of them never hit land at all. Some of them have wound down considerably or haven't intensified up to their peak by the time they hit land. This was just a really bad luck is what you have to ascribe this to.
And how does it, you mentioned it's a Cat 5 storm. How does this compare to Superstorm Sandy, which hit the East Coast here in the U.S. last year?
Well, it's a great comparison. So Sandy was, by some measures, not even a Cat 1, or at most a Cat 1 hurricane, and it yet did all this destruction. What that illustrates more than anything else, and I think this is an incredibly important message, is that there is no single number, there is no scale that you can event that really conveys the risk. There is a reason that we give these storms names, and that is they all have their individual characteristics, like snowflakes. So Sandy, although it wasn't very strong in terms of peak winds, was slow moving and enormous in diameter. And we all knew that it was going to cause a really big storm surge in New Jersey and New York, and it did. In the case of this latest typhoon in the Philippines, you had also a large storm, not perhaps as large as Sandy, but really, really high winds in the core. Lots and lots of rain from this, and it also created a big surge because of the intensity of the winds.
So, Kerry, here's the big question. There's a lot of speculation whenever there's a big storm these days. Did climate change play a role?
Well, certainly it played a role in one obvious respect, is that sea level is elevated, and so the storm surge, which is a big killer and causes a lot of destruction, both in the case of Sandy in the case of this most recent storm, was higher than it would have been. Beyond that, though, it's difficult and perhaps impossible to attribute one particular event to any kind of climate signal, whether it's global warming or El Nino or some other phenomenon.
Kerry Emanuel is a professor of atmospheric science at MIT. Kerry, thank you so much.
You're quite welcome.
The Bay Area in California is home to the largest Filipino community outside of the islands. The World's Monica Campbell visited St. Andrew's Catholic Church in Daly City, just south of San Francisco, and she spoke with one family waiting for word on their loved ones back home.
My name is Ferdinand Cahigal.
I'm Marilyn Cahigal. My whole family is there, actually. Tacloban City, and my hometown is Alang-Alang Lady.
That's 30 kilometers away from the center of the storm. But her brother, on the day of the storm, he went to work at Palu, which is where the storm is at.
And his name is Ismael Vergara.
I went there about a year and a half ago, and to this area, and some of the houses were right on the shore, and I was saying how blessed they were because they are right on the beach. But with a force like that it's like gonna be like paper. I just hope that they were able to go away or go up to the mountains or something, because there's no way they would survive the surge of the storm or something like that.
And how are you keeping up with the news from here?
I just look at the YouTube, most
CNN, YouTube, and then there's a thing, philistar.com from the Philippines. We try to monitor that in the internet. The worst part is not knowing.
There's no communication.
Ferdinand and Marilyn Cahigal in Daly City, California. They're waiting to hear from their family back in the Philippines. Later in the program, what we should keep in mind when contributing to aid groups providing typhoon relief. You're listening to The World on PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from PBS, presenting a new presidential portrait from American experience. JFK premieres tonight at 9, 8 Central on PBS. And by Reputation.com, dedicated to helping individuals and businesses make a strong first impression on the Internet by ensuring accurate search results and authentic online reviews. Learn more at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION.
I'm Aaron Schachter. This is The World. On Veterans Day, we pause to thank those who've served in our military forces, but few of us remember that the actual holiday began as a way to mark the end of World War I on November 11, 1918. That's why November 11th is also a holiday in other countries like Britain and Germany. World War I was called the war to end all wars, but of course it didn't. Today, for The World That Was, we're going to talk about two men who served on opposite sides in World War I. Chris Wolfe is here. Chris, who is on your mind?
The first man we're going to talk about is a young British infantry soldier by the name of Henry Tandy from Warwickshire in central England.
Henry Tandy, what's so special about him?
Well, he survived 4 years on the Western Front. He was wounded twice and returned to duty each time and was decorated with Britain's highest award. It's like the Medal of Honor, the Victoria Cross. But something extraordinary happened to him 20 years after the war. He got a phone call that might have sounded something like this.
You will now hear a statement by the Prime Minister.
I am speaking to you from the Cabinet Room at 10 Downing Street.
Now, that's British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain addressing the nation, not Lance Corporal Tandy. But he did call Tandy in 1938, just gotten back from meeting Adolf Hitler at Berchtesgaden, Hitler's mountain retreat near Munich. And Hitler had asked him to pass on his thanks to Tandy for sparing his life during a battle in World War One.
How did that come about?
Well, the story, according to Hitler, was that he was wounded and a British soldier had him in his sights and saw that he was wounded. They're close enough to make eye contact. The British soldier lowered his gun. Hitler nodded in thanks and crawled away. And that was the story that Hitler told Chamberlain, and somehow he'd managed to identify Tandy as the soldier who had saved his life.
Yeah, how is it possible that he figured out it was Lance Corporal Tandy who did that?
I know, it's impossible to believe that you could pin it on one particular person, but Tandy's picture had gotten in the paper after he got the Victoria Cross. Hitler decided when he saw it that that was the guy, so he'd kept the cutting for 20 years. And a few years later, he arranged to have a copy made of a painting about World War One featuring Tandy. And it was hanging in his office when Chamberlain came to visit, and that's how the subject came up.
Chris, is there any chance it really could have been Lance Corporal Tandy?
Probably not. Tandy did have a code of honor of his own in his life as a combat soldier, where if a soldier, enemy soldier, was wounded and disarmed and out of the fight, he wouldn't kill him. But I was very skeptical when I stumbled across the story and did some digging. There's some circumstantial evidence. Their units were kind of in the same area twice during the war in 1914 and 1918 facing each other. But the actual dates of Hitler's and Tandy's service don't quite match up. So it's almost impossible that it was actually this guy. But Hitler certainly believed it happened. Hitler did have this experience that he recalled so clearly, being spared by a British soldier, and Chamberlain certainly made that call.
And Tandy gets a phone call from the Prime Minister, Neville Chamberlain. How does he respond to that?
Well, apparently he took it all very matter-of-fact and didn't think much about it. You know, World War II hadn't started, so he didn't really care who Hitler was. But then once the war came and the bombing of British cities started, Tandy was mortified by that. In fact, there's a quote from him. If only I'd known what he would turn out to be. When I saw all the people, women and children he had killed and wounded, I was sorry to God that I let him go.
Well, it's quite a legacy, isn't it? The World's Chris Wolf, thank you as always.
You're welcome.
Later on the program, we'll ask a 2-star U.S. Army Reserve general for her thoughts on this Veterans Day, including some advice for vets returning from duty. Okay, now from military heroes to fantasy superheroes. Quick, which ones come to mind first? Superman, maybe? Or Spider-Man, Batman, Iron Man, Captain America? Did you notice they're all white men? Well, comic creators are trying to diversify their superhero ranks, and last week Marvel unveiled a new comic book series with a very different sort of hero. The World's intern Emily Files explains how this new character came about.
My name is Ms. Marvel, and I'm here to welcome you to Earth. Now go home.
Sound familiar? That's from a classic TV episode featuring Miss Marvel, also known as Carol Danvers. Her blonde hair flows as she fights the bad guys. That Miss Marvel is now becoming Captain Marvel, and the new Miss Marvel is a completely different character. She's a 16-year-old Pakistani-American, a Muslim girl from New Jersey. Her name is Kamala Khan.
When the story opens, she is hanging out in the local 7-Eleven, and she's with one of her best friends, and she's sort of staring at this messy, big, disgusting, but delicious-smelling BLT sandwich that is sitting at the front of the store. And she and her best friend, who has just decided to start wearing hijab and covering her hair, have a discussion about bacon,
which is against Muslim dietary restrictions. That was Willow Wilson, who authors the new Miss Marvel comic. Wilson lives in Seattle and converted to Islam 10 years ago. Her own life helps her write Kamala's story, but the story behind Kamala is mostly inspired by another one of her creators, Sana Aminat, an editor at Marvel Comics.
In the town that I grew up in, there weren't many people who looked like me or who had my background in different ways, not only just in terms of me being Muslim or Pakistani, but just in terms of my personality and the way my family was.
In some ways, Aminat is like the superhero she created. She's also Pakistani, Muslim, and from Jersey. The idea for Kamala Khan sprung from a chat she had with another Marvel editor, Stephen Wacker. They were talking about their family backgrounds.
That spurred into him coming in excitedly one day and saying, wouldn't it be great if we had a superhero that for all those little girls who are growing up the way that you did.
So Aminat went for it.
We've had many diverse characters at Marvel, but nobody at the forefront on this scale.
Even before her debut this February, superhero Kamala Khan is already gaining fans. Shalina John Muhammad, a Muslim author in London, is thrilled that people like her daughter will have a superhero they can relate to.
And I really wish for my own sake that I'd had a superhero like Kamala Khan to try and help me make sense of angst and just once in a while to come out of that geeky, angsty, slightly awkward teenage phase and see that I too could be some kind of superhero.
Kamala Khan's teenage angst is like many others. But as she struggles to figure herself out, she discovers her superpowers. She can grow, shrink, and shapeshift. And besides being a rare female superhero, Kamala is also the first Muslim superhero with her own solo comic book series at Marvel. Shalina John Muhammad, the author in London, said she's never read comic books before, but she's planning on buying this one. And she thinks people who don't normally go for comics might do the same.
I think they've done something very savvy in terms of business, but also they've made a very interesting social development.
Of course, the satirical news site The Onion already has its take on Kamala Khan. They wrote, "I don't think we're ready for a superhero," from New Jersey. And Aminat's response?
I understand the joke behind it because a lot of people can make fun of New Jersey, but come on. We have a superhero now.
For The World, I'm Emily Files.
I wonder what exit she's from. You can see what Kamala Khan and her family look like. We've got pictures at PRI.org. This is The World on PRI. I'm Aaron Schachter, ahead fighting to breathe in China.
When you were walking in the streets in Beijing, you see more and more people putting on respiratory masks.
And blaming the pollution on the Chinese government.
If you are the only power, you also are the only people to blame.
China gets serious about its air pollution. That story just ahead after the news.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, supporting the American Diabetes Association in their effort to prevent and cure diabetes and to improve the lives of all people affected by diabetes. You can test your risk for diabetes at stopdiabetesnow.com.
I'm Aaron Schachter in for Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Imagine waking up to air pollution so bad, like a heavy fog, that you can hardly see what's around you, buildings or cars or even people near you on the street. That's what life can be like in many of China's big cities. But there is something that urban Chinese are seeing more of these days, as The World's Matthew Bell reports from Beijing.
It's a little after 6 p.m., and Huang Wei is getting ready to head home from her office in downtown Beijing. As always, she opens up an app on her smartphone to check the air quality. And it's bad.
It's not good for exercising.
And Huang commutes by bike, so she knows what she has to do.
You better put on the mask.
The face mask she's wearing is white with a little plastic valve on the front, and it's held on by two yellow elastic bands. It's a respirator, the sort of thing you might wear at home when you're doing some sanding or painting. Now, Huang Wei, she works for the environmental group Greenpeace. She's hyper-aware of the dangers of air pollution, but she's not the only one wearing a mask these days.
Actually, when you were walking in the streets in Beijing, you see more and more people putting on the right respiratory masks.
Looking around during afternoon rush hour, I noticed that most people don't have masks on, but it doesn't take long to find people wearing them. Take a woman named Lena and her friend.
You're wearing a mask here. You're probably walking home from work.
Yeah.
Why is the mask important?
Because the smog here is so heavy and the environment is not very good.
But they say they don't like having to take this precaution. The masks can actually get kind of grungy.
You know, it's smelly. I think that smells like bad eggs. You know that.
The masks are designed to keep that smelly pollution from getting into your lungs. The biggest concern, tiny particles that can cause not only breathing problems, but can damage your heart and other organs. Some manufacturers claim their masks will remove more than 90% of those particles. Now, for the masks to work right, they have to fit nice and snug with no gaps on the sides. But people don't always wear them properly. So how important is it to wear one, really? I went to Peking University to ask Tong Ju. He's a professor of environmental science and engineering.
Do you wear the mask sometimes?
No, I never use that.
He says wearing a mask is inconvenient and uncomfortable, and he's not convinced it's worth wearing on a regular basis.
It's not fully protection. I would say that's useful for certain level.
So when the level of those tiny particles is extremely high on really bad air days, the professor says it's probably worth putting on a mask, especially for kids and people with health problems. But there are questions about whether the masks are really as effective as advertised. Tong Ju is conducting a study to find out. Still, for some Beijingers, effectiveness clearly isn't their sole concern. I've seen respirators in funky colors and even one that looks like a teddy bear face.
The next station is...
On the subway, I meet a young woman sporting a face mask in a sort of gray herringbone pattern.
Did you get this one because it looks cooler than the other kind?
Yes, she says. The first reason she wears it is for protection, and the second as sort of a fashion statement. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell in Beijing.
Matthew's got some striking pictures of China's face mask fashion, and he schools us on the proper way to wear one in a video there at PRI.org. And we're going to stick with Matthew for just a couple minutes here. Matthew, I've got to ask you, those face masks are certainly fashionable, but, you know, this is a big, big problem, and face masks are not going to solve it.
That's right. And the Chinese government, interestingly, has done a 180 on this, actually, Aaron. When the U.S. Embassy here in Beijing started monitoring air pollution and then putting that information out on Twitter a couple of years ago, the Chinese government took offense. They basically said Washington is taking a political cheap shot at China. But now China's Environment Ministry has its own monitoring program, and they put that information out. This is generally considered to be well-run, accurate data, and that's the information behind the smartphone applications that I was referring to in my story.
Why the sudden turnaround?
Probably the biggest factor has been these recent episodes of unbelievably shocking air pollution. Last month in the city of Harbin, which is way up north, the smog got so bad you couldn't see halfway across the street. Schools closed, roads closed. That was Harbin. Earlier this year in Beijing, the capital, something very similar happened. The public is a lot more concerned at this point than ever. I talked about this, Aaron, the other day with a longtime China watcher. Isabel Hilton is her name. She's been coming to China since the 1970s, and she runs a website called China Dialogue, which covers environmental issues in China. Hilton told me there's been a real shift on the issue of air pollution.
There was a time maybe 10 years ago when people were almost proud of smog because it meant we're industrializing, we're becoming a real country. We have the problems of modernity rather than the problems of the Middle Ages. So this was regarded as progress. That moment has definitely passed. And these very serious episodes have brought terrific pressure on the government. If you are the only power, you also are the only people to blame, and they know that.
What are some of the things that China is actually doing to change air quality?
In September, the Chinese government came out with some targets and said that they would reduce coal consumption. They've been investing in public transportation, in alternative energies, in electric cars. But the thing is, environmentalists will tell you that it's probably not enough because, again, the problem gets back to coal. That's the real fundamental issue here. And they say that China is not being ambitious enough. And that's because the model of economic growth that China adopted 30 years ago has been dependent on cheap, plentiful energy in the form of coal. So if they're going to go in a different direction, that's a fundamental shift, and it's not going to be solved quickly.
The World's Matthew Bell in Beijing. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Aaron.
Another place where chronic air pollution is proving very difficult to tackle is Tehran. Schools in the Iranian capital are closed for 3 days this week, and the government agencies have been ordered to shorten their hours as the city suffers through its latest bout of crippling smog. Iran's health ministry says air pollution contributed to nearly 4,500 deaths in Tehran alone last year and nearly 80,000 across the country. Efforts to tackle the problem in recent years have largely failed. If you happened to be in Turkey yesterday, you would have heard a good bit of commotion. The country was observing the 75th anniversary of the death of the founder of the modern Turkish state. Reporter Jacob Resnick dropped in on one guy who was marking the day in his own unusual way.
It's perhaps the noisiest moment of silence in the world. Each year on November 10th, sirens, whistles, and horns erupt for about a minute at 9:05 a.m. to mark the passing of Mustafa Kemal Atatürk. He created the modern nation-state of Turkey from the ashes of the Ottoman Empire after World War I. Yesterday in the capital Ankara, about a million people turned out at its mausoleum, which was open late into the night. In Istanbul, tens of thousands of people crowded in and around Dolmabahçe, the 19th-century Ottoman palace where Atatürk died 75 years ago. Others have come up with novel ways to honor modern Turkey's secular founder. At his tattoo parlor in Istanbul's fashionable Moda neighborhood, Danny Garcia offers free tattoos of the late statesman's signature. Garcia grew up in Germany, the son of a Spanish father and Turkish mother. He says he admires Atatürk for westernizing Turkey, and he's disturbed by what he sees as a growing gap between Eastern and Western values in Turkey.
We are trying to be modern or European, you know, and the other side tries to go back, you know, like the Islamic culture.
Garcia says just a few years ago, dozens would line up for the free tattoo. This year, only one client.
Actually, only one man who got the sign. It was Sunday, we had a football match, I don't know. I hope that was what affected, not something else, you know.
It's possible that people were distracted by a big soccer match, but the reality is Turkey is changing fast. For the past 10 years, the government has been run by the Islamist AK Party, and public signs of religion are increasingly acceptable. Earlier this month, the state religious directorate issued an advisor on its website saying tattoos are unclean and not in accordance with Islam. Garcia says he's not too worried about what that means for his business.
I don't take it for real important, actually.
And in the meantime, anyone who wants a free Atatürk tattoo in Istanbul will just have to wait until next year. For the world, I'm Jacob Resnick, Istanbul.
How's this for Veterans Day? We're going to speak now with a 2-star Army Reserve general who commands 20,000 soldiers in 19 states. Major General Megan Tatu has spent 30 years on active and reserve duty. She's commanded at every level, from platoon to division leadership. During the Cold War, she was the first woman in an air defense battalion in West Germany. She also commanded more than 2,000 soldiers at Joint Base Balad in Iraq. Today, I asked Major General Tatu what Veterans Day means to her, both personally and professionally.
From the professional perspective, you know, I think of how for nearly a century we've celebrated our veterans on this day. And I think about the sacrifice that comes with service, because I know firsthand that it includes for many missing the birth of a child or the graduation of a loved one that can never be replaced in their lives. You know, these are the very personal reflections of this day for me.
Are you frustrated at all that people spend the day going shopping, likely, instead of remembering the service of others?
In the Army, one of our core values is selfless service, which by its very nature, it's hard for many veterans to accept a thank you, because we don't serve for the recognition. But when it does come during reflective times like a Veterans Day, it's important.
Now, you say serving in the military is a selfless act, but when servicemen and women come back from serving now in Iraq and Afghanistan, they do need some special care. What advice would you give those returning troops and soldiers?
I think most importantly is that they take advantage of the services that are provided if they are having difficulty with the transition. We have, through all the generations, over 700,000 veterans who are unemployed, and there have been the Heroes to Hire program, and in the Army Reserve, specifically the Employer Partnership Office, designed to help veterans transition into employment. And so these programs are discussed and made available during the transition from military service, you know, into the civilian communities. Those that might be having a difficult transition with behavioral health issues, there are, again, a number of opportunities to be able to seek help and services. And so we highly encourage that they take advantage of those and to not be afraid to ask for that support.
We asked some of our listeners who are veterans the question I just asked you, what advice do you have for those returning from Iraq and Afghanistan? And we have a gentleman, Ian Blake from Huntsville, Alabama, said, don't expect anything more than lip service. If you get more, it's a bonus, but your experience doesn't translate to civilians. Another from a listener from Louisville, Kentucky, he said, the general public and even your friends don't really care that you deployed. Life still went on without you. Would you say that this is a common experience that vets have? You commanded a few thousand in Iraq?
You know, the expression band of brothers is applicable in this, in that you can't relate to experiences unless you have experienced them yourself. I've raised a child with a disability. I can't expect those that don't have those trials to understand what we've had to work through in the school system to get services and that type of thing. So in that sense, the shared experiences, whether it have been through a contingency operation or in a peacetime, it's the experiences are unique and are best shared amongst those who have been through similar experiences.
Right. We have another note from a listener, veteran Jonathan Taylor from Austin, Texas, and he said, just accept that people can love you without understanding you.
Now, the American people now, as opposed to the Vietnam War era, they make the distinction between those who make policy versus the men and women in uniform. I will tell you that unbeknownst to me, when I headed out for my initial train-up before deployment to Iraq, that my entire neighborhood hung out American flags, and they stood outside their houses and they applauded as I drove off.
General, can I just ask you personally, is there someone you remember, especially on Veterans Day, someone you hold in your heart, a mentor perhaps?
Well, I'll tell you, I didn't know my grandfather. He passed away shortly after I was born, but I still have his service ribbon, his medal from service in France during World War I. And I always pull that medal out on this day. And I think in terms of the sacrifices he made to leave his family. And he was an artilleryman, and we always carried with us, we had his Doughboy helmet. He had an expended artillery shell. But I always reflect when I look at that medal, the fact that we have men and women who voluntarily take that step to obligate themselves to support and defend the Constitution of the United States, every one of them, I have tremendous admiration for.
Major General Tatu, thank you so much for speaking with us and for your service, and happy Veterans Day.
Thank you very much. You take care.
For more on veterans returning home after life on the battlefield, including five pieces of advice from vets, check out PRI.org. You're listening to PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Reputation.com, dedicated to helping individuals and businesses make a strong first impression on the Internet by ensuring accurate search results and authentic online reviews. Learn more at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. And by Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
I'm Aaron Schachter. This is The World.
I am reaching out to the people, to the whole world, to please open your hearts and help the Philippines. Do not abandon us. Any help, big and small, will come a long way.
A Filipina in London whose own children are missing back in the Philippines after Typhoon Haiyan's devastation. Storm survivors desperately need the help. And when we hear of their plight, most of us want to help, but sometimes it's hard to know how. Amy Costello is a former Africa correspondent for The World. She now hosts the podcast Tiny Spark, which investigates the business of doing good. We asked Amy what we should keep in mind when contributing to aid groups providing typhoon relief.
one of the most important criteria should probably be that the organization has a national or ideally international reputation, has deep experience responding to these kinds of crisis and emergencies. It's incredibly difficult to operate in these kinds of conditions when there's no roads, no hospitals. So rather than giving your money to a small, perhaps local organization that doesn't have experience but has very good intentions, I think it makes most sense to put your money behind a national or international organization who you know knows how to operate in these kind of conditions.
There are on occasion people who decide, you know, I want to go there and help. Is that a practical thing to do? Is that really helpful?
It depends. A government spokesman from the Philippines recently said that they have a big need for technical experts. That would be people who can restore communication lines and power and water supplies, and they also need medical assistance. And so people with specialized skills may be able to offer a very important hand, but there are some caveats to that. And I think until these places can actually be accessed, it might be better for people with specialized skills to sit tight and wait until they can be assured that they can actually get to the places that need help.
Right. Now, Amy, you investigated the problems with medical volunteers who went to Haiti after the earthquake there. Lots of lessons were learned. Anything that might apply to the Philippines?
So what happened in Haiti after the earthquake is that lots of well-intentioned medical volunteers took leave of their jobs from hospitals and went down for a few days or maybe up to a couple of weeks at a time. But one of the things that led to was a real breakdown in the quality of care that was delivered because there was no continuity. There was very little record keeping. And so patient care really declined because of this kind of ad hoc nature of the volunteer response. And another thing that I discovered in investigating medical volunteers who went to Haiti after the earthquake is that many of them actually caused harm to patients because they didn't have adequate training. One thing that every medical volunteer needs before they go to a place like the Philippines or to another international emergency is to have training in international emergency medicine and to also have experience working in developing nations before they deploy.
I don't know. What's the difference, Amy? If you're an emergency room doctor or nurse, shouldn't you have the skills?
You have skills to provide medical care in a highly resourced hospital in an American city. What you don't necessarily have the skills for is how to deliver appropriate medical care in very low resource settings. And what happened in Haiti is that many surgeons arrived in Haiti, for instance, without anesthesia. They assumed it would be provided for them. And so they arrived in Haiti without anesthesia and had to wait for anesthesia to arrive. And in the interim, patients got sicker and sicker, and many, unfortunately, died.
Amy Costello, thank you as always for your insights.
You're welcome, Aaron.
Amy Costello is a former Africa correspondent for The World. She now hosts the podcast Tiny Spark, which investigates the business of doing good. She is also producing a global investigative series with The World called Tracking Charity. You can see her stories at PRI.org/trackingcharity. Finally today, African rhythms are the DNA of Latin music, but we don't often hear African voices delivering those lyrics. Cue the latest pick from our guest DJ, Tom Schnabel.
I'm excited about a new tropical Latin record called Viva Africando. It was the brainchild of a Malian arranger and music director, Bonkana Maiga. The band actually started 20 years ago. This is the band's eighth album. Like the earlier albums that have ignited dance floors in New York, Los Angeles, West Africa, London, and Paris, the new CD was produced by Ibrahim Silla, widely regarded as the Quincy Jones of African music. Was called Dundari from the new album Africando featuring singer Sekuba Bambino from Guinea. One of the things I love about Africando is all the different singers from all the different West African countries. They bring a whole new energy to this music. Here's another track that I want to play for you. It's called Shalas Shalas. This reflects West Africa's enduring love of Cuban music.
Yalla defko Yalla yalla bay sotol Gor gor lo jam tia kanam
Dido sandau sayo wi sorina Boy do sandau selul saganau.
The West African love affair with Cuban music started in the early 1950s when a boatload of 78 RPM records got dropped off in port cities and the flame was started. The West Africans went crazy for this music. They found something familiar in it that they remembered, but it was kind of like a new and improved version of something they already knew. I can't say enough good things about Viva Africando. It's an eclectic labor of love for tropical music created against all odds. It's truly a love letter to Puerto Rico and Cuba from all these great West African and Caribbean musicians.
That was Tom Schnabel of Station KCRW out in Santa Monica, California. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Aaron Schachter. Marco Werman is back tomorrow. Thanks for listening.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI and WGBH, supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, Artworks, by Nan and Bill Harris, committed to supporting objective, unbiased reporting on national and international issues, by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs and their innovations to solve the world's most pressing problems at skoll.org, the Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs, by the PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors to the trust include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Tagney-Jones Family Fund, and the Rose Family Fund, and by the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include John and Caroline Ballantyne, Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation, and Michael and Anne Cerisi.
PRI, Public Radio International.